Well, welcome back in the sixth floor of La France, which, as you would have understood, is a country that has floors. So we are going to continue to our travel throughout the total mobilization of the web. This afternoon, we are going to listen to Mila Doi, Jacopo Domenicucci, and Angela Condello. Mila Doi, who is historian of religion and currently holder of the chaire d'humanisme numérique at Sorbonne Nouvelle, author of many books in English and in French, among the most recent, La Grande Conversion Numérique and Pour un Humanisme Numérique, both aux éditions du Seuil, at the Edition du Seuil, is going to talk about social realism in the algorithmic web. I give you the floor.
What I'll try to do in the 30 minutes or so I have is perhaps not to talk about the title I gave, but perhaps something that may be related to the interventions this morning that I think are ultimately more pertinent to our discussions and exchanges. First of all, I would like to say a couple of words to put in context where I come from and the few observations I will share with you. They are mostly actually questions I have instead of either exposition or answers. For about 4 or 5 years, I've been interested in trying to work out the what I would call the mythology of the notion of intelligence as the founding myth of computing, not computing science. And if you're interested, there has been a recent interesting debate, especially by Donald Knuth against the historians of science and of computing science as the necessary distinction between the two concepts or way to describe how computing started and evolved, because I think it may be relevant. And in the process of working on these issues, I think I've come to some questions that are relevant to both what Maurizio presented this morning and especially also what Antonio did. But before I just say the few things I have along these problematics, I would like to just give you an idea how I came to this problem, because it's completely by chance and by accident. I was interested in thinking a little bit about the notion of race and the way it relates to digital culture. That may sound completely kind of odd, but actually it's intriguing when one looks into both the kind of conversions of biology and computing on the one hand, and how it sort of made possible particular kind of discourses that we associate mostly, but not exclusively today, with transhumanist discourses. So there is something quite interesting that was going on. And in the process of working on this, I fell upon a book that probably you know better than I do. I didn't know of its existence. It's called The Stupid Man. L'homme stupide. And I figured it's interesting to start something about intelligence by something that on stupidity instead of intelligence. Turn out the book is quite fascinating. It's very brief. It's available free online from the site of Sciences Sociales in Canada. And it's written by the first Nobel Prize in Medicine in France, Charles Richer. And it's quite intriguing because it's one of the most racist books you will ever read. It has chapters about, you know, the Redskins, the Negroes, and so on and so forth. It goes on detailing all the horrors of humanity and its failure. But what's intriguing about it is that this conclusion, actually, is a kind of an argument for a form of what would we call today digital eugenism that is very well worked out despite the kind of blatant discourse on that is extremely racist and can be shocking, actually, if you read it exclusively from that perspective. By doing so, so I decided to work on this notion of intelligence and obviously looking at the text, and I'll come back to it in 1 second. But before, I would like to say something, since especially Antonio mentioned the Turk. It's something I've been very interested in precisely because of the first thesis on history by Walter Benjamin, who, I don't know if you recall it, I don't need to kind of reproduce it, he begins exactly with that particular machine by describing it and by going into the details of the outfit that the Turkish sort of fake player, and then at the end he describes and he calls it a puppe in German, and then he says at the end it's actually a midget that is hidden beneath the machine that is a master of at playing chess, and this midget will always win. But what's interesting, obviously, is that the last two lines in Benjamin's text, he says we have to think about this hidden face of the master chess player as historical materialism and its contest with theology and revelation. That's why I think it's perhaps extremely relevant. So what I'd like to propose to you is that with this notion of double-faced between what is visible, what is accessible, the mask of a particular kind of colored representation of a masterful player, particularly in strategy games, and the real master that is beneath, we can perhaps, and this is going on from what was said this morning, postulate something that is equivalent but completely different because of the new environment in which we live, that will be of the nature of digital materialism and the sense of historical materialism for the period of, shall we say, from the end of the 18th century to the early or mid 20th century. And indeed, in that case, we are sort of invited to question and to think through what kind of issues and questions we can have about relation both theological, revelation-related, and the constitution of a form of digital materialism. Of course, we can be easily led to think almost exclusively this notion of digital materialism as a form of inscription. That would be the recording, the transactional aspect, the kind of informatic notion. But it seems to me there is a kind of an emerging dialectic that we see that is both transformative and highly difficult to completely kind of seize in its own. The other interesting part about it is that we can also do a brief and obviously very summary history of early computing by associating with different notions of play and game. It is no coincidence, it seems to me, that Turing begins with an imitation game. Von Neumann has versions of game theory, despite what people say that has nothing to do with computing. I think they are wrong, because von Neumann started very early in his career writing about what later will become his masterpiece with his co-author, the Theory of Game. And of course, we can go on further if you accept a kind of a sociological perspective. If you look at the thesis and at the first book by someone like Goffman, who will very early will postulate the information game as a key to analyze the constitution of a particular kind of persona, initially within an professional environment, but later he will extend the analysis. It seems to me there is a syncopation that is very significant between the notion of game, playing a particular kind of game. What's interesting is, of course, we have different kind of games at stake. We have tactical games, we have strategic games, and we have social games. And what I find interesting in trying to think through some of the issues that are raised by the early text on computing is precisely there is a divide that we still are living with today and that shapes to some degree both our reflections and at the same time our engagement, I would say, with the digital environment. On the one hand, we have the computing, calculating side, shall we say, that is more toward the strategic games, chess and all kind of variations. In that sense, we can sort of take and look at, and if we have time, we can go over it, if you would like, in the discussions, if there is any time left, people like Herbert Simon, Newell, and so on and so forth, who work extensively on those particular kind of rational constructed games. At the same time, we have the social game that is part, that is a constitutive part of the discourse that is of Turing. And Turing is intriguing because the two texts, 1948, Intelligent Machinery, 1950, Computing, Machinery, and Intelligence, give us two perspectives that are very different. One is completely within the tactical calculating, and the other one is what he calls very explicitly over and over again, the social game. The machine that is thinking, not necessarily intelligent in 1950, is a social machine. It's compared to a child. It has to be inserted within a particular environment and ecosystem, and from that particular environment has to learn along the model of the way the child would learn. And then he will talk exclusively in some ways and quite almost prophetic words about what he called social search. It occurs in the concluding paragraph of Intelligent Machinery. And today, precisely what we're negotiating with are the kind of the way this structuring of social searches are fashioning both, not necessarily identities, but their exploitations of form of presence, I would say, instead of talking about digital identity. So this is sort of the first take, and I will come back to it a little bit. The second take, and this is again, because once we think through the notion of intelligence and especially the way it has shaped some of the computing evolution, we are immediately led, I think, along two tracks. At least that's the perspective I took. The first one is that it invites us to rethink what I would call the conflictual heritage of the 18th century and the philosophies of the Enlightenment, and that we can see precisely within the notion of responsibility, especially with the notion of autonomy. I think it's key. Because precisely the discourse today, and I'm sure I don't need to go over it, all the debates and the polemics that are related to the future of artificial intelligence, its relationship to the human, humanity, humankind, and so on and so forth, precisely comes from that particular translation within the notion of autonomy. Furthermore, it seems to me, but that's my own eccentric take, and I think I'm sure you will have probably objections to it, it seems to me also to be nourished and shaped by an extensively monotheistic interpretation of modalities of creation instead of emergence. We are into kind of a biblical narrative that keeps coming back over and over again. We can see it in the histories that has been written. The classic work is McDermott, for instance. We'll go back to the Bible or to the Golem. We have the two kind of classical models, and when there is a variation, we'll have Mary Shelley, Frankenstein, and the monster. And yet, it's always precisely the relationship between the creator and his or her creation and the rivalry that is inevitable between the two that would lead to the situation that we are facing today. There's been a recent book in the US that is a tremendous hit called The Last Creation, which precisely describes artificial intelligence as the last creation by humankind, because then it'll be the end, so to speak. It's almost a Nietzschean narrative, the way Nietzsche in The Antichrist will describe how God made the fatal mistake when he created man, and it sort of led to his own and in some particular way. Now, that's interesting because precisely we see an intersection of a theological construction heritage that is kind of still feeding through some of those issues that are with us today. And curiously enough, it's mostly the scientists who are carrying this discourse, not the people from the humanities or the social sciences. You know, you look at The Guardian and so on and so forth, you have 58 signatures. Most of them are, you know, computing scientists, biologists, astrophysicists, physicists, and so on and so forth. So it's kind of interesting to go back and think through it. My version of it is probably a little melodramatic, but I call it, by paraphrasing the Freudian expression, instead of penis envy, it's religious envy. Is that there is the scientists always have to be able to tell us what happened at the origins and at the beginning. And when they do so, they fall back on the most classical scenarios we know, all of us, and that obviously raises a lot of problems with what they are saying. But instead, what is perhaps maybe relevant to discuss this is, first of all, to point out that 1950 is an interesting year in this perspective, because we have both the text by Turing, we have von Neumann's text, The Computer and the Brain, and we have at the same time Wiener's first publications on the issue. Perhaps the most interesting is von Neumann, because he's considered to be the kind of both hesitant in some ways about the future of artificial intelligence, especially in its relationship to the human brain. And his conclusion, I think, is absolutely remarkable and has been almost forgotten because it's both technical and philosophical. And normally, he's not a philosophical man. He was either a mathematician, a physicist, and so on and so forth. And what he says is the following. I have the quote if you want to later, but I won't bore you with reading. It's sort of one of those lengthy phrases, endless paragraphs. What he says is the following. He says, indeed, we may one day arrive at producing results by constructing sophisticated and complex computing machines that will give us similar conclusions as to the brain, to which the brains can arrive. But we should be extremely careful not to generalize that we have arrived at the way the brain thinks. And he said, instead, we have to think of the mathematical translation into computing as a short code. And short code, obviously, is opposed to a technical term, because it was defined at the time by Turing, and later by what he called brief code and short code that was developed with the early computing machine. And therefore, there is something quite interesting that is taking place. And I would call it, in English, it's easy to express, is that we may one day, with the cognitive science, with all kind of these, arrive at what would call the surface of the brain, but the mind remains inaccessible in some particular way, if we accept that distinction the way it is deployed within, shall we say, analytic philosophical tradition. Now, of course, if you accept this particular kind of split and distinction, it's interesting to go back to the Turk and the machine. Because then we can see precisely the same scenario taking place, except with its transformation. We have the visible Turk, the Turkish, as Antonio showed them, who traveled across the circus from Vienna and so on and so forth. And what is hidden is sort of so-called the mind. What's intriguing is that the mind was represented at that particular time, in that particular moment, as something on the limits of things, is almost monstrous. It's either a midget or a handicapped or a crippled, but not fully formed, but instead privileging, instead of the physiological appearance, the mind and the brain and so-called the computing power. And that's something I think has kind of shaped in a surreptitious way, it seems to me, the installation of this kind of infinite infancy of computing and computing science. It is always in its childhood. It will never reach the age of the adult, because it's always going to renew itself, discover new things, and so on and so forth, which had allowed different variations of developments and work. The reason one I'm pointing out these rather details, because it seems to me they would allow us a way to think about autonomy that is very different from the traditional, conventional way it has been thought out, and that is in terms of a particular kind of almost autochthony of the human. That is a kind of what will define the human, is a form of autochthony that is sometimes expressed as autonomy. So I did the philological exercise that sort of I'm used to, and then went to the old dictionaries and looked up the definitions of autonomy. It's very easy. We all know a little bit Greek, autonomos, he who gives himself or herself his own, shall we say, rules or laws. But what's more revealing is that when you start look at the examples that are given to explain and illustrate how autonomy works, and that I think we get into something more interesting that will touch a little bit perhaps on the algorithmic side. And then the most common sentence, at least in the French tradition, let's say, but it's also available in English, is the following. Rome as a sovereign empire chose at times to allow certain Greek states to live according to their old rules and laws. So immediately we understand something very interesting. In order to affirm autonomy, you delegate it. And that, I think, what is very crucial. And precisely the issues perhaps that are raised today are how to think through delegation instead of autonomy vis-a-vis what is either emerging as a digital environment, as a form of artificial collective intelligence, and so on and so forth. Once we move from the discourse of autonomy as this kind of presupposed particular the concept attached to exclusively the human as a collective or as a kind, it becomes much more interesting, because then the question, obviously, we know how to deal with delegation. And the two things one gets from the old text about delegations, they insist on it, and the Encyclopedia of D'Alembert and Diderot is quite explicit about this, is that it has three characteristics. You mostly delegate in times of crisis, and you delegate to either the military or to the legal profession, judges. But the key element is to simply have a provisional form of delegation. And I think the notion of this kind of ephemeral provisional is crucial. So now if we go back and look at the first definitions of the algorithm that are in the founding text of computing, whether it's Turing, von Neumann, Wiener, Shannon, so we can make a list. The first thing they insist is the algorithm function by provisional validation. That is sort of almost a common notion. And it only learns precisely because of the nature of this ephemeral provisional form of validation. Now, of course, now we have complexified it, but nevertheless, that notion of the provisional is very crucial. It seems to me there is a transfer between a particular quality, a conception that is attached to the specificity of human governance, into the modality of the constitution of the algorithm itself very early on, that for a while disappeared because of the debates between the Macy conferences, the Dartmouth conferences, between McCarthy and company about the notions in Minsk and so on, about the artificial intelligence. And now that has come back precisely through what we would call the social graph, to, for just simply to go at it quickly. And what I find interesting is precisely why this notion of the provisional has been absolutely identified and attached with intelligence, particularly in today's environment, which perhaps explain the hyperinflation of the use of the word intelligence. Everything has become intelligent, the object, the wall, the interfaces, the cities, except perhaps us. But nevertheless, we have everything that's surrounding us, that is coming, that is being promised, is considered and thought of as provisional. The second dimension that strikes me about these texts, I don't know if you've reread them recently, there is a peculiar recurrence of a figure that is at least surprising in some cases, and that is Saint Augustine. If you read Turing, he will cite him twice in Intelligent Machinery, which is quite shocking, actually. You know, he was not the type to go read problems of grace and election and Christian doctrine and so on and so forth. But yet he will refer to him. And also Wiener, if you remember the last five or six pages of the first two editions, and which is the final edition of Cybernetics, it is a reflection on St. Augustine. And sort of I was curious to figure out why this sort of odd presence was in a debate where he couldn't be further removed. And it seems that this sort of perhaps can be explained along two tracks. The first, and this I obviously am here doing my own version of them, is that because precisely the relations that can exist between the modification within the human nature that is perceived, that can be brought about by computing. And if we accept that particular notion, then Augustine becomes a significant reference. Because what happens with Augustine in his construction of the notion of grace is that he completely modified the way we understood human nature, in the sense it is something that is awaiting an event to happen on the horizon of revelation. And that is what will distinguish particularly the construction that is Augustinian from what preceded it in sort of the polytheistic world that he was fighting against. And in that sense, I would say computing, and particularly the digital, is precisely building itself, and that's where we go back to the notion, and Benjamin is very relevant in this particular notion, the particular aspect, precisely in the dynamic that is no longer necessarily between historical materialism and theology and revelation, but instead of digital materialism, and this notion of waiting for something to happen that is almost messianic, but in a particular sense that we can find in Benjamin's writing. The second aspect is, again, I think relevant, and that is, and this is where Wiener, I think, is absolutely remarkable and lucid about it. And I remind you, in case you probably know the text, he also wrote a beautiful book called God, Golem, Inc., that won at the time the award from the American Academy of Science, where he basically contested this notion of the golem. He said, basically, we're just falling into a trap if we're going to think about the construction of automation. And he was interested in something that's today absolutely relevant, which is the links between automation and autonomy. That was his thing. And he wrote a beautiful novel that very few people read, except some people, called The Tempter, to try to kind of construct the world around. But what he found interesting, which I think perhaps is even more complex and perhaps relevant, is that he discovered, and he obviously was, as you know, he was a child prodigy who did both a thesis in mathematics and as well in philosophy. He remembered that in some of the debates, which may sound totally esoteric to us today, between St. Augustine, who used to be Manichaean for 7 or 8 years of his life, and his former friends and colleagues, basically turned around not necessarily the problem of evil, but instead of the problem of chance, how to conceive chance within the structured universe. And what Wiener extracted from that is precisely the problem of randomness, both in the technical term in computing, but also in its broader sense within the construction of forms of autonomy that he was interested in. And there I think we tend to find already within the early, I would say, phase or kind of nascent production of computing, a number of elements that take us back to some of the issues that I think were raised this morning. Perhaps to give a couple of illustrations that are, you know, very minor of how this kind of is interesting, and that goes along in part what Antonio did with digital labor as well as some of the other things. It's perhaps interesting to see that one of the shifts that we have been living through, in part under the pressure, I would say, of the so-called social, the way at least the digital has constructed it, from a paradigm that is basically a paradigm of the index, where the search engines functioned along a model that is relatively supple, shall we say, but nevertheless was one of adequation. You ask for something, we'll try to give you an answer that is considered to be as relevant or as pertinent to what you request. And that, you know, was some other variables taken into account. And instead, we slowly moved into a model that is a model of recommendation. And the model of recommendation is extremely different and completely shifts the paradigm. First of all, because the way we have recommendations today with minor exceptions is basically based on what to take advantage of what Antonio did on digital labor. We're going to take your data, your aggregate history, at least the identity or that is at stake, and we're going to consider pertinence, and that's where I think it becomes into some issues that may be related to what Jacopo will be talking about, the notion of viability of the relevant and the relevance of the recommendations is in terms of your own social network as it is constructed and conceived by the algorithm itself. Now, we can have variations in that particular construction of the error, but nevertheless, we're going to come back and use those particular aspects in order to give you some particular. Now, obviously, we can use that in ways that is extremely useful. That is kind of the predictive side that can be interesting, saves us time, as we seem to think we need time to be saved. But at the same time, and this is the part I'm interested in, it seems to lead to surreptitious form of prescription. That is sort of doubly inscribed within this particular form of social construction of pertinence, of context, and its displacement from one model to the other. And there I think we start to have some kind of need to resist the question and to think through how these operations are being put together. Now, obviously, in this particular context, we can see very quickly that the issue of intelligence is central, whether it's as a marketing tool or whether it's something that is considered to be a, I'm going to say theological version, an incarnation of the way computing world today, at least within its commercial expression, conceives of intelligence. In other words, it's going to translate what it can do in such a manner to tell us that is the intelligent way to do things. Basically. And there, obviously, it's interesting to go back to the history and try to question also why particular models have dominated or may have been sort of sidetracked in order to deal with it. And I think I still have some time. Second dimension I've sort of find interesting with this both the kind of odd heritage we have of the 18th century, as well as some of the key notions that one can get between revelation, theological dimensions, and the forms of digital materialism, is that, at least, but that's my own take, is double. The first, it seems to me, is extremely difficult today to talk about the web as a notion, as a concept, as a word that sort of can capture something. First of all, because what we're living with today, precisely in part because of the convergence between the mobility, the emergence of the kind of the cellular and everything that has included, but especially that's how led to kind of the creation of relatively small numbers of closed gardens, shall we say, to use the regular expression, that is slowly moving us away from a particular economy in the etymological sense of the term, from the web as we have known it, whether it was celebrated as as the age of freedom or not, into something that is significantly different, that is sort of gives us the image or the illusion that we are in the web, but actually we are somewhere else. We're within these particular geographies that has been determined, and I think there's a serious tension and conflict between what the web is and could be, and at the same time what is being shaped into by these very very heavy actors that are kind of moving us slowly away within the way they're producing tools, app stores, and you know, all the stuff we are very familiar with. This, I think, is very important because we're going to have kind of a cohabitation between a web that is still is, in some sense, the infrastructure upon which we're building. And now if you follow the technical things, I find it very interesting that there is a lot of effort that come from these big actors, whether it's Google or Facebook, to introduce new technical aspects in order to expedite the web, for instance, mm-hmm. to allow all kinds of things, in order to reinforce precisely this kind of curious separation between what the web is, was, and how it's sort of being moved, if it is this particular physical place. And I think that is a very serious and interesting issue, precisely because that's where we see the kind of odd delegations that we have done without realizing we've done it in effect. We've transferred some particular kind of access. Second aspect that relates to this particular construction seems to me to come from the fact that the shift to the model of recommendation is kind of contradictory, or at least is inhabited by a very powerful tension. On the one hand, it has moved us away from the kind of utopian, celebrated the appearance of the borders, the kind of free circulation of ideas, and by removing us into these gardens. But at the same time, it has allowed, and that's what's very interesting, a powerful return in some cases of the local, whether that local is defined and understood by a language, by a culture, and so on and so forth. And that's kind of a very curious tension that we see. But beyond that, and that sort of is minimal, what is perhaps more relevant is precisely with this return of the local, we have a return particularly of at least a will, maybe it has not yet fully been put into action, of the authority of the territorial. And that, I think, we find very powerful, whether at the national level or at a broader level. You know, we have Europe versus U.S. with the particular conceptions, debates not only about privacy, about status of data, about status of number of states, but also particularly within national borders, they're being reconfigured via the redefinitions and the adaptability, I would say, to forms of governance that are playing into what is supposed to be either protection of citizens and so on and so forth. Not necessarily opposed to it, but I think it's interesting to see that that is the way that the territorial authorities have found powerful means in order to reassert both their legitimacy and to reconstruct it in ways that are viable within the digital environment. And perhaps to try to conclude, because it was interesting to see some of the terms that that were used to describe the particular structures and oppositions between before and sort of during the digital era. It's interesting, perhaps, and particularly I was obviously very delighted to hear the word paleontology come back, because it seems to me it is perhaps timely to reread also, if you are, we're going to stick for now because we don't have time, with the French tradition. It's interesting to go reread someone like Le Roi Gouron. Not to reread him simply to see whether in Le Geste et la Parole the question of externalization or the question of the rhythmicity, but instead the way he constructed something that I think today with some modifications can be extremely powerful to allow us to develop tools to see how the digital environment is shaping things. And that is, he wrote two volumes that I think not as well read anymore, Milieu et Technique. They're quite fascinating because he tried to think through precisely the notion of milieu. And I think that's where the kind of issue, because we can translate it as context, but perhaps environment is more appropriate. And what I propose instead of milieu et technique is instead milieu numérique. First of all, because it seems to me that the word technique, both with its metaphysical heritage and all the philosophical discourses associated to it, whether it's Heideggerian or others, is no longer sufficient to capture what the digital is in its complexity, whether from the point of view of code, and not simply as a system of writing, but as a kind of a form of calculability that I think needs to be thought through in different ways. And here I remind you the beautiful, I'm going to butcher it, but that's okay, a quote from Wittgenstein on certainty. And he says, basically, we only learned what calculating is by calculating. And I think that's extremely powerful, precisely because we assume that calculating is the same over time, but instead, actually, from 1950 to today, it's changed dramatically. And we need to kind of look through and see what do we mean when we think about computing, calculating today, and particularly within a perspective that is, shall we say, to take the Wittgenstein point of view, a theory of action. But an action both from double-sided action, both from the individual engagement, whether it's via an injunction or otherwise, or from the construction that is sort of relatively autonomous, quotation marks, or automated from the algorithmic side. And the second element that, again, seems to be relevant, and that is perhaps sociological, but I think is very interesting. If one reads a beautiful text by someone like Zimmel, who obviously was interested in things related to numbers because we're interested in money, but also he was interested in the city. And he wrote a very beautiful book about sort of the life in the city. If you read the first two pages, it's very striking. I don't remember the German now offhand, but he basically starts by saying he's struck that the contemporary individual has become way too calculating. And then he talks about the digital, actually, not just simply adding and subtracting and so on. And my hypothesis is we are invited to think that today the human, shall we say, that's probably the easiest way to say, is calculable. And that is sort of the interesting shift from the period that was before 1950 to the period that is today. And the question is, perhaps it is calculable. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that, except we still need to know what does calculable mean. Is it simply by measuring, by coloring, producing cartographies of the mind, of the hand, and so on and so forth, or do we mean something fundamentally different and other? And there, I think there is a lot of issues that perhaps are related to what brings us here. And to finally conclude, I think I'm within not going over time. I would like just to end very briefly by a quick reference to what Wiener said very early on. He realized very quickly, once he developed the first equations of Lübeck by modifying them, when he used to work on artillery and the calculation, when he developed kind of the complex notion he will have later about feedback, is that suddenly we are in a new, different era because of the nature, material nature of information. And his first conclusion was not that simply computing is going to change, but instead our notion of ourself and a property is radically other and different. And I think he was absolutely right on. And we sort of kind of forgot what he said. Because first of all, it can explain some of the difficulties we have with copyright, with intellectual property, and so on. But nevertheless, it's also the notion of property as it is understood as a form of delegated autonomy of the human. And I think that's where perhaps is the fundamental insight of Wiener. And perhaps I will stop right there, and I thank you.
Sense of the term technique instead of numeric or other. You mentioned that the Wagurin, and as you can imagine, I perfectly agree with this. But the advantage with the term technique is that we can make a chronology which is. Much higher than and this can help us to overcome this kind of transcendental illusion that consists in saying now I understand.
I heard. No, because it was not so important. You can answer also without having heard, but it's somehow useful. This kind of transcendental illusion we have always find in the study of the so-called new media, that there is something completely new who has nothing to do with the previous humanity and introduce deformation, alienation. Mm-hmm. And if we are able to show this continuity, for instance, from the fire to the electricity, I find it by chance I had exactly the Italian translation of the book you mentioned, and don't know why. I don't travel. Usually I don't travel, but I know that Jacopo Domenicucci had an identical copy of this, because we both find it in a Bookinist. What is beautiful is that there is this map that shows from the fire up to the electricity.
I can absolutely agree with what you're saying, because I certainly do not argue that suddenly we have this absolutely kind of rupture that is completely radically different. That I absolutely can agree with. The difficulty I tend to have with technique or techné and also on so forth, it has been so over invested in particular discourses that I think it's become unfortunate. We have a number of instances like this. Virtual is another case that we have kind of, we either go Leibnizian or Aristotelian, we can go over and over again, and so on. That is sort of, I think, the reason I would, otherwise I personally, obviously, very clearly, I'm much more of the side of a kind of perspective, if one has the capacity to do it, of what Le Roy Gouron managed to do. What's interesting in the case of Le Roy Gouron, he reflected in the second edition, he wrote just a 4 or 5 pages preface to the second edition of the two volumes, that he's basically said he still accepts all the conclusions, except he questions some of the choice of the vocabulary. And when you read very carefully, you can see he sort of has changed because he saw it. And if you read what he has published in between, and I found that I may be mistaken here, he wrote a very beautiful tiny little essay that was reproduced later in the second volume of Le Reste et la Parole about how memory is represented by using punch cards in computing. And that sort of changed his perspective. It was not necessarily the same gesture of rhythmicity and exteriorization, but he said there was a kind of a materiality that was different, that related to this big machine that sort of went and came back. And he wrote very beautiful analysis of it. I think there was a kind of perhaps an intuition with Le Roy Gouron that there is perhaps an interesting thing to do. Now, do we have a real, I think, satisfactory substitute? I don't think so myself. And obviously the word digital is complex, numérique or digital, and so on. We can get into those. It's very, very difficult to find a substitute to technique. So I do agree. It's just simply something that I find intriguing to think through more than anything else.
Thank you very much, Milad. I hope that we'll have other things to about trust later and what you said about fiability. But could you come back on the monotheistic stuff? On what you mentioned about the Bible model?
Well, I think we seem to have basically a narrative that is extremely seductive, and it's also reassuring for a particular notion of the human in some ways, that creation has to... best way to answer is basically to use the Hollywood answers, because I think it's incredibly efficient and it simplifies things in such a way that it sells and makes a lot of money. If you look at all the books of science fiction that have been turned into science fiction movies, it's very interesting to compare the text to the movie version. The movie version, I think I'm probably exaggerating, but you probably agree, is very simple. We create a machine, the machine looks up to us, and suddenly, because of the relationship that is almost this particular kind of bond that exists by the act of creation, tries to be like us. and that's very difficult. Sense of humor, you know it from Star Trek. There are all kind of variations on the scenario. And after a point, the machine becomes intelligent, and now we have about 50 different series and movies in the last 3 years. And suddenly it looks around again after a while when it reaches sufficient level of, shall we say, knowledge and enlightenment, as the transhumanists say, decide the human needs help. They need to be improved. Tries to improve us, we're hopeless. And the solution is basically to eliminate us. And so therefore we have a perfect scenario that happens. And I think that is basically a variation on the biblical model. Another variation on it, which I think very interesting, and we've had it with the machine, but that leads to something more interesting, if I may take 2 minutes to answer. And that is, this: if you take the Christian interpretation of it anyway, there is the notion of the hidden God, the Deus absconditus. And that becomes much more interesting, because suddenly there is a kind of a fact of almost a disappointment instead of a kind of a form of rivalry that gets in place. And with the withdrawal of the creator from the scene, there is, and Kant, if you remember, in the conjectures on the beginning of human history, we'll say that is the beginning of human history, when basically the gods left, because otherwise we were doing something else and we were still stuck with them, to basically go at it very quick. But instead what we have today, and that's what I think very interesting, and you can make the describe the moments it has occurred, we have seen the machine take shape and body. And I've done a little study trying to see at what moment, for when you look at the history of computing and the construction of the machines, the first thing machine learns is to write. That's very interesting. It does not have a voice. It does not have a body. It does not have all kind of things. Slowly it will reach a body, and we have either the real representations of it, or we have it in, as in the movie by Kubrick, you know, we have the thing with the light that flashes. And a little later, and that's what becomes much more interesting, it reaches two different stages. Both it has interiority, and that becomes very fascinating. And that is, you go inside the body of the machine, and suddenly this is infinite space. If you're a science fiction fan, you think of Doctor Who and his TARDIS, you know, it's very, but we have it, it started with the human body, which is the great movie, I forget now what it's called, when they were the medical team that goes inside the body of some important figure that tried to save him, 1963-64, the name will come to me, and very quickly afterwards we have people going inside the machines, and suddenly the machines are no longer just tiny space, but instead it's expanded, it's almost infinite. And the ultimate illustration of it we will have in Tron. You know, you're into arcade, you go in, and then you want to come out. Third part, and I think that's what becomes more interesting, is when the machine has a face. And if you look at the history of the representations, when it reaches kind of takes a face, it's very interesting. It's not necessarily a human face. It has all kind of different shapes. And slowly we settle on a kind of a minor variations on the human face. And then it has voice and so on and so forth. So I think just we had a seriously anthropomorphic representation of this stuff. It's quite interesting that way. In science fiction, obviously, we had a lot of different versions. Of the machines, of its shape, of what kind of body, if you want to call it body. If you look from the 1940s onward, you will find very rich variations that never made it into, except with the few, happy few who sort of read these kind of texts. So I think that's the kind of monotheistic is extremely powerful. One last comment on the monotheistic. It's very interesting to read the transhumanist discourse from this perspective. They seem to, in their majority, shall we say, reject the monotheistic by going to polytheism, but especially by going to a combination of a new age and, I would say, Asian forms of Buddhism. And what's interesting about them is that they forgot that the West was not always monotheistic. I mean, what do you do with Greece and Rome, for God's sake? It's just, why is it interesting that you have to go to this? And I think there are reasons for that that are quite complex and rich, but this that shows you that this is kind of the sensible point where something kind of shifts within that particular both community and imagination.
You never mentioned, you speak a lot about intelligence, but you never mentioned consciousness. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether the difference that you seems to indicate between genuine human intelligence and putative machine intelligence is related to consciousness, or is just two kinds of intelligence that in your view are different for other reasons, not because not we have because consciousness, whereas machine
no, I didn't want to get into that debate, first of all, because as you very well know, especially that Searle will be here, that's the debate that has shaped some of the philosophical exchanges between consciousness, intentionality on the one hand, and the construction of so on. And it seems to me that was perhaps very useful, but it's a dead end. In some ways. What I find interesting when I was working on intelligence is to write something without giving a definition of intelligence. It's the only way to have it be operational. Otherwise, you're going to be completely stuck. The only interesting text that I found gives almost a definition without doing it is a tiny brief lecture given by Bergson to high school kids. He had a director of one of the schools in Paris who was his friend invited him to when they give the prizes at the end of the year, and he chose the team intelligence. And he did a very beautiful discourse without giving one single moment a definition of it. And very quickly I realized that's the trap to avoid. I think the moment we try to attach it either to the human, to the conscious and so on and so forth, we enter into these sort of very powerful debates about dualism, about the status of the body and consciousness and so on and so forth. I think the people who are most interested in artificial intelligence have realized that's the thing to avoid. And what they've done, and in some ways we see it now emerging in a number of different ways, they shifted to notions of autonomy. And that's where they go back also to the 18th century. Because once you go to autonomy, you go to the legal aspect of it. And that's what becomes extremely powerful. And particularly if you're in a commons law tradition, that is actually quite significant because of the first case against slavery that gave a particular form of autonomy that later would be extended to the animal realm, and now within that discourse will be extended to the what we call digital creatures. And therefore they avoid the difficulty of the problem by sort of sidestepping it, I would say. The only exception is probably someone like Kurzweil, who still wants to be able to come back to it. And if you look at the latest book by Kurzweil, it's interesting. He basically gives up on all the stuff he did in the past. And interestingly enough, he goes back to von Neumann. And he said we have to use both his cellular mathematics, the way it was developed by Wolfram, but go back to the simplicity of the model instead of its complexity in order to capture something like consciousness. But that's very elaborate argument he has. It's interesting.
I hope to be quick, but actually it's kind of complicated because I just wanted to ask you if you could please develop on the very idea of delegation, which I find fascinating. And myself, I've been, interested in it, especially when I was studying the way we use certain technological systems to delegate to them some of the tasks that previously were delegated to other authorities,
of course,
which kind of resonates with what you were saying. I was thinking about how we now delegate to systems of recommendation of friendship,
exactly.
The people we could become friend with, where previously we used, cultural authorities or religious authorities, so, it's our teacher that tell, to children who they should become friends. So, actually, beyond this question, there is also the idea, and I just wanted to run it by you and see what you think about this, that delegation actually presupposes a certain stance towards machine, meaning that if we presuppose delegation, we also presuppose that machines do things for us, which kind of also, comes with... what I've been telling you about or showing about digital labor is that we also do an awful lot of things for the machines, by clicking and by training them. And also that sometimes we do things against the machine, not only in terms of resistance, but in terms of thinking technicity as a technique of survival. I'm because you like to quote, old books. Myself, I like to quote old books. I remember the 1934 book by Jacob Moreno created the very social network analysis, Who Shall Survive?
Yes.
That was a really fantastic book, fantastic reading, where this guy was really, really interested in knowing what would happen if we had, different collectives of human beings in competition. Immigrants against natives racial tensions. And eventually he concludes this book in a very interesting way by saying, what would happen if we had to compete against machines? if we had to compete for our survival against automation, which of course, you know, it's also, But so, and again, can we think delegation in a scenario where we do not use machines to do things for us, but we do things with machines, for machines,
I would say absolutely. Butler was most interested in evolution. He very quickly observed that technical evolution can be fast. Biological evolution is slow. And he was sort of interested in trying to think through that problem. And he was in New Zealand at the time, and he wanted to kind of tease out some issues with... See, why I'm telling the story, to try to answer it also, because it's a very, I think, very important question. And so he wrote this very beautiful text called Darwin Among the Machines, in which he says, you know, he's, if you read, for instance, Dune, Frank Herbert, that's why they have the Butlerian Jihad. It's named after him. The fight, the war to the death against the machines. And what Butler says is actually much more interesting and much more complex. He says, obviously, since the invention of the clock, we have been subservient and subjugated to a manner of managing time that has modified our kind of interactions in the social world. But that's not as important. What's important is then when we started to miniaturize the clock into watches, because we carried them with us on our own bodies, and that became extremely dangerous. Because therefore, in that scenario, and that's why I'm quoting him, we started working for the machines. We started delegating to the machine, not against the machine. And he says we have to think through and out ways to try to at least reverse some of that trend that seems to be for most inescapable. And I think that's precisely one of the questions, that how to delegate not necessarily to the machine, but to go. Now, obviously, there are a lot of ways people can think about it. Perhaps the most classical way was in a French context, to go back to the notion you quoted, you mentioned when you were talking, and it's the notion of cunning, of métis, which can be either the status of the hacker who will just take something and just shift it around, make it do what's not intended, whatever that means at a particular moment. So that notion of métis comes back. It's interesting at the same time to read métis not only through the version that de Certeau, no matter how admirable it was in his presentation, but also in its Greek version, the way it was done early on by Détienne and Vernon. What they show us very quickly, and that was later developed by someone like Greg Nagy at Harvard, is that métis is only significant in a context and an ecosystem where it's opposed to biais in Greek, to force and violence. And that's what I think is very interesting, is that the notion of métis takes on its full power within this particular ecosystem. And I think the question of delegation is precisely along those models, I would say. Obviously, we have to think it through very differently from the classical conventional ways we may have thought about it, because we have situation, maybe they're not utterly new, but they're different, and they require different ways. The second aspect that seems to me, again, you know, we do a lot for the machines, the machine does, and so on and so forth, and since you quoted, you know, the it's interesting to look at those early texts, to go back to Le Roi Gourand. He has a beautiful chapter in Milieu et Technique called Savages, Barbarians, and Civilized. And I just find it fascinating, because what he's interested in, the barbarians are not interesting. The people who are interesting are the savages. And he just immediately saw that. My version of it is very simple, but because I think, you know, I like the geeks. I partially was a geek a little bit, and it's always good to use to tease them, shall we say, is that for a long time in the etymological and social sense within the American context that I know a little bit better, because that's where I live, the geeks were the savages of our societies. They were powerful, they were recognized, but nevertheless. And today I would say we are the savages, but not distant savages in Polynesia, but I said we are where we always were. But we become the savages in something that we're being shaped and civilized. And this is where the question of delegation comes. And therefore, it's interesting to go back to this particular kind of cunning bricolage, if you want to use the Lévi-Strauss term, and so on and so forth. I know Philippe is, was waiting for the word, probably. It's interesting to go back to that thing. But what's interesting is even the Greek term is eventually is always opposed to sheer force. And in the Odyssey, you have, you know, Achilles on one hand, Odysseus on the other hand. The clash is very, very classical.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.